Nitzachim, Perek Dalet, Mishnah Aleph, 4:1, a new chapter here, and this chapter will focus in the big picture on the topic of doing malacha, of working on the 14th of Nisan, an Erev Pesach. We'll have an interesting side point for a number of Mishnahs talking about minhagim, and various minhagim that have nothing to do with Pesach necessarily. But in any case, here in the first mission, we lay down the rule regarding the minhag, the custom of not working on Erev Pesach, which existed in some communities. So our mission is going to be concerned with the question about what happens if you are out of town for this Pesach, and the minhag in where you are currently conflicts with the minhag that you have back home. That is to say, some communities had the minhag of working on Erev Pesach, and some didn't. In all events, make sure this is clear, we're talking about doing work in the first half of the day. The second half of the day, on the 14th of Nisan, really is very similar to the halachas of Chol HaMoed, and Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of the Yom Tov, between the first and last day of Pesach, or 2 days in the case of the Chutz La'aretz. Chol HaMoed proper, malach is totally forbidden. I think people miss this point, and even though it's not our topic, I want to get on my soapbox for just a moment. During Chol HaMoed, malacha is asur, it's forbidden. There are exceptions to that rule where you're doing something for the sake of the Yom Tov, or it's a davar avid, you're going to lose out if you don't do it now, etc. But in general, working during Chol HaMoed is forbidden. Do malacha, I should say. Now, that's essentially the same is true on Erev Pesach on the second half of the day after Chatzos, which is like a mini, like almost like it's a festive in nature, it's like a holiday. But the first half of the day, really it's permitted to do malacha. However, many communities had a minhag not to do malacha on Erev Pesach on the first half of the day because they were concerned people would get carried away with their work on Erev Pesach and not do their biur properly or their preparation for their matzahs properly or their preparation for their seder properly. Don't forget, there was a strong, essentially universal minhag in the time of the Mishnah that they would bake their matzahs after Chatzos. And there are even shittas, by the way, that it's not kosher to use matzahs that were made before Chatzos, believe it or not. Nowadays, I think most people don't do that, but there are some who still are strict to make their matzahs in the afternoon, Erev Pesach. Be that as it may, the question is now, back to our basic question, what happens if your local custom where you are for this Pesach is in conflict with your minhag back home? So the Mishnah is going to say, in one short answer, you keep the strictures of both. But here it says inside, Makom shenagu la'asos malacha ba'arvei pesachim ad chatzos osen. In communities where the custom is to yes do malacha on Erev Pesach in the first half of the day, then if you're there, go right ahead. Makom shenagu shelo la'asos. If you're in a place where the minhag is not to do malacha on Erev Pesach first half of the day, ein osen. It's forbidden to do malacha because you have to conform to your local minhagim. This, by the way, I should have emphasized really before I started, is a really central point in Jewish law and Jewish life and Jewish worldview, that we want to keep our minhagim going. We really want to have a tremendous fidelity to our traditions. Certainly in the pre-Mishnaic era, when nothing was written down, essentially all we had to go on was our traditions. Nowadays, since halacha is codified, so minhagim might be slightly less important, but nevertheless, the basic principle here is that a Jew is meant to hold on to his customs very tightly, and not let them go so easily. And therefore, if you're in conflict, if back home where you came from, they would yes do malacha, but you move now to a place they don't do malacha, or if you come from a place where they didn't do malacha, to a place they did do malacha, nosen alav chumrei makam sheyatza misham, v'chumrei makam shalach l'sham. We put upon him the strictures of both, meaning, in this case, whether his usual custom back home was not to do malacha, or his current locale's custom is not to do malacha, either way, we forbid him to do malacha now. Okay? Now, there's always a conflicting value of what Chazal referred to as mechsi kayura, which means literally means ostensible arrogance, looking, you know, hubris, that you look like you're, you know, too big for your boots. But that's a value to itself. There's the most ugly of all midos in the Jewish worldview is gaiva's arrogance. So we certainly don't want a person to even look like he's arrogant, let alone actually inculcate the meat of arrogance, thinking that he's what he isn't. And therefore, sometimes you have to contend with that conflicting value. But in the case here, that's not an issue. In other words, if a person found himself in a community where they, yes, did do malacha, and he has a custom from back home not to do malacha, we're telling him here also he should not do malacha, being machmer, like his minhag from back home. And if you would say, well, that could be like the mechzikayura value that we're concerned that it looks like he's arrogant because everyone else is doing work and he isn't, the answer is there's no such concern, at least in this context, because if he's sitting around twiddling the thumbs on Erev Pesach or playing backgammon or whatever he's doing instead of doing work, people will think, okay, the guy's unemployed, so he has no job to do, nothing to do, so that's why he's twiddling his thumbs. They won't think he thinks he's too good to do malach on Erev Shabbos, whatever the story is, on Erev Pesach, whatever the story is. Okay, fine. So the guiding principle here is very simple then, which is you go machmir according to both minhagim. And now the Mishnah gives a reason why. Va'al yishan adam, a person shouldn't deviate from the local customs, mipnei ha-machlokas, because of machlokas, of infighting. And this is a major central Jewish value, of course, that we want communal harmony. Westerners who come from individualistic societies sometimes get a little uncomfortable with customs or practices or rules that infringe upon their personal freedoms. But the Torah doesn't care about that so much. It's concerned about not just your fulfillment as an individual, but also for harmony as a community and for the larger community of all of Klal Yisrael. And that being the case, there's few things worse than machlokas. And that being the case, we want the local community to have a sense of harmony, and we don't want people to have variant customs which would lead to disagreements or worse. So therefore, we want people to have a common custom. Now, just one thing to be clear here. We're talking about a case, the whole context, the presupposition of our Mishnah is that we're talking about a person who's visiting a locale with a different minhag from his own, but he's only there temporarily, and he intends at some point to go back home. If he is now in his new location indefinitely, and he has no intention to return back home, so then essentially he is to take on the minhagim of the new location, and really to some degree abandon his old minhagim. Exactly how that would play out halacha l'maisa would depend on a number of factors, so if that happens to you, you need to ask your local rabbi. Certainly, this question comes up in Eretz Yisrael every year around the holidays, the regalim, when people say, do I have to keep, quote unquote, keep one day or keep 2 days of Yom Tov, end quote. Not discussing that anymore over here, but it's certainly, this is a complicated halacha issue, so ask your local Orthodox rabbi if it applies to you. Pesachim, Perek Dalet, Mishnah based 4:2. Now the Mishnah is going to go off topic here. We're going to talk about other kinds of minhagim that have nothing to do with Pesach, but since in the previous Mishnah we said the basic guiding principle, which was that one has to keep his local custom, and he has to keep the custom of where he is now, and he has to be strict for both, we'll have a similar kind of principle guiding in a few Mishnayos here. This particular Mishnah, actually, to be honest, is not speaking about minhagim per se at all. In fact, when the Mishnah says kiyotzibo, which means something like similarly, this is in contrast to the other word which means similarly, which is v'chein. When the Mishnah says v'chein, it means the same principles at work, just has a different manifestation. When it says kiyotzibo, we mean that something seems similar, structurally similar, perhaps, or the externalities that seem a similar one to the next, so therefore we're going to mention them together. But the guiding principle at work is not the same. And that's what's happening here. Our Mishnah actually, in truth, is not referring to Minhagim at all, but actually a din. But it's structurally similar in as much as we're contrasting when you have conflicting dinim relative to where you are now versus where you came from, or vice versa. And our topic here in our Mishnah here is the halachas of Shvias, and particularly the halach of Biur on Shvias. So Shvias is the Shemitah year, the seventh year. And there's an obligation called biur, which is basically that one has to rid from his possession, I'll call it for right now, produce at a certain point when that produce is no longer available in the wild. The idea being that the pasuk says that in the seventh year, the land is Hashem's and everything is hefker, ownerless, and one cannot work the fields and so on, but that which grows naturally, I'm ignoring the Isser Durban here for a second, is the Isser Svichen. Whatever grows on its own is mutter for everybody. So you can't plant apple trees, of course, but apples that grow on the apple trees are permitted to everybody. And the Pasuk says not just everybody, but to the animals in the fields as well. From which it's learned that everyone has equal access, and as someone who would restrict access to his private apple tree so that his neighbors couldn't access it would be over Nisra Daraisa, and restrictions can come from there. But the basic idea is that the apple tree now is not privately his, it's everyone's, including the animals, and one has to conduct himself as such, which means you're prohibited, amongst other things, from harvesting too many apples and bringing them home, etc. Now, so long as there are apples available in the trees for the animals, so then apples in your home, at least if you take them in small quantity, that's fine. At some point, the apples will no longer be available in the wild. At that point, since the animals can get it, you can't have special access to apples. So at that point, it's called the time for beer kicks in, and you have to rid yourself of those apples. You can't have special dominion over the apples. So there's a cutoff period. The cutoff period is when they're no longer available in the fields, in the wild, for the animals, and no longer allowed for you as well. At that point, the time for beer, getting rid of the apples, kicks in. Now, two things. First of all, what do we mean by beer? And second of all, what do we mean by available in the wild? So, as far as what we mean by beer is, it's actually machlokus. The Rambam learns straightforwardly that beer means destruction, like beer chametz. And that being the case, when the time comes, there's no more apples on the fields outside, then the apples in your home must be destroyed. Most Rishonim ever learn that, most Rishonim learn that to simply rid them from your possession by being mafka them, by rendering them ownerless, relinquishing ownership of those particular produce when the time comes, is sufficient. And then after he is mafka them and makes them available to the public and everyone else, he can reclaim them for himself if he so chooses. And that is certainly what you see people do in Eretz Yisrael these days. So that's what we're talking about, beer, getting rid, removing your possession, even if you reclaim it after your mafkaret, according to most. As far as available in the field, so this whole Mishnah, actually, this topic appears in the ninth parak of Shvias, the end there of Shvias, and there it says that Eretz Yisrael is divided into three different zones, kind of like microclimates, climactic zones. And since what fruit is available in the wild in these different zones vary from zone to zone, so therefore we are concerned not with what's available in all of Eretz Yisrael, but what's available in your particular zone. In other words, that's sort of a necessity, right? Because just because the apples are finished on your tree, does that mean they're unavailable in the wild? If they're available in the next tree's over, of course. So you have to draw a line somewhere. So the Mishnah says there are three zones. You have Yehuda, like Jerusalem environs. You have Galil, which is to the north of Israel. And you have Eder HaYarden, to the east of Israel. Those are three separate climactic zones, three different halachic zones. And we're talking about if in your particular zone, the given item of produce is no longer available. So our mission is going to simply say, like structure like the previous mission, which is, if you're coming from a zone where time for beer kicked in, and you've moved to a zone where there's no beer on this particular fruit yet, still you have to be strict and do beer. And similarly, if you've come from a zone where there's no beer, but you entered to a zone where there is now beer on this particular item of produce, you have to do beer as well. Strict both ways. And that's what the mission says here. Kiyotibo, similarly, at least structurally, similarly to the previous Mishnah, meaning you should take the strictures of both. Hamolech peros shvias memakum shekalu. If you take Shemitah produce from a place where that produce is no longer available, lemakum shelo kalu, to a place where it, yes, is available. Or alternatively, memakum shelo kalu, you started the produce from a place where it hadn't yet been consumed in the wild, lemakum shekalu, when you transport it to a place where it is now no longer available in the wild. In both scenarios, chayav leva'er, the obligation for beer kicks in now. Restrict both ways. Fine. The second sentence of this Mishnah, taken out of context, and here it is really taken out of context, it appears also in Masechet Shvias, is very difficult to understand. I'm going to tell you what it means, and then we'll do our best to see it in the words, although you're not going to see it in the words, not really in the words, because there's no context here, and the words themselves, even in context, back there in Shvias, are hard to understand what they mean, literally. But in any case, the basic case here of our Mishnah is, what happens if you have pickling in a jar, let's say three different kinds of vegetables? So you have your green tomatoes and your red peppers and your cucumbers all pickling together. Delicious. Now what happens if when Zman beer kicks in for the first of those three vegetables? So there's no longer any red peppers available in the field. So you now, of course, certainly have to be concerned about the mixture. So the question is, what do you do with the mixture? And actually, believe it or not, there are three opinions in back there in Shvias. Rabbi Eliezer goes strictly, and he says, listen, If any of the three items are forbidden, because beer is kicked in, all three of the types of foods are forbidden, because each one has absorbed taste of the others. And Tom Ka'ikar, we're concerned about the taste, there's taste here which is significant, and therefore since your cucumbers are infused with pepper flavor, and the peppers have beer, so too does the cucumber have beer requirements. That's Rabbi Eliezer Shita. He's going the strictest. There's Rabbi Yeshua, who has a very lenient opinion, who learns out from some verse, that even if one of them have passed, or two of them have passed on the deadline for beer, all three remain permitted, because each of the three contain elements of heter, and that's sufficient when it comes to Zman beer. It's a very lenient opinion. And the third opinion is that we don't consider taste relevant as far as beer goes, meaning the obligation to do beer and rid yourself of the produce applies to mamashos, actual substance of the fruit, but not to the flavors in the fruit. And that being the case, you just have to take each different type of vegetable as it comes. When the cucumbers are no longer available in the fields, the cucumbers have to be removed from the pickling jar, and then the tomatoes get removed, and so on. The halacha is like that third shita, that we don't concern ourselves with taste when it comes to beer, and Rabbi Yehuda is coming from the same position. So Rabbi Yehuda is basically coming off the question that we just raised, which is what do you do if you have three different kinds of fruits pickling in the jar? And his answer is, well, each fruit, one at a time, has to be removed from the jar, because now time for beer for that particular fruit has kicked in, and we don't concern ourselves with the taste that's absorbed from the species that has to be mivor, has to be removed and absorbed into the species that don't yet have a beer requirement. All he actually says, though, is essentially, I'll read the words exactly, actually. He says, Rebut Omer, Omrim lo, we tell him, the guy who raised the question, do I need to get rid of these pickles now that there are no longer any cucumbers in the field? We say, yes, you do, because Tseiv Ha've Lecha Afata, which means something like, go ahead and look for yourself, and if you can't find cucumbers, that means the time for cucumbers have arrived. That's a sentiment, that's his point. The actual words literally mean, Tsei, go out, Vahave Lecha, and bring for yourself Afata. Also, you like, go right ahead and try to find cucumbers. And the proof will be in the pudding, so to speak. If you can't find cucumbers, cucumbers are now forbidden because Zman beer is kicked in, but the other vegetables in the jar, the tomatoes and the peppers, still remain permitted. And that basically is the halacha l'maisa. Pesachim, Perek Daled, Mishnah Gimel, 4-3, and more about minhagim. Here we actually talk about a real minhag again. And we're talking about the minhag of not selling small livestock, meaning goats and sheep, to Gentiles. Now this minhag, where it exists, is driven by the fact that there is a din derabanan, a real din derabanan, that one may not sell large draft animals, meaning cows, horses, and donkeys, to Gentiles. And the reason for that din derabanan is because we're concerned that people would come to lease their livestock to Gentiles to do work for the Gentile on Shabbos. The idea being that a person can't do his own malacha on Shabbos, so he figures, listen, I have this idle asset, my cow, and it could be pulling a plow. If I rent it to a Gentile for Shabbos, I can get an extra, you know, make some extra money on the side. The problem is the Torah requires shvisas behemtecha, the resting of your animals on Shabbos. They get a day off too, and therefore one would be over an iser d'oraisa if you would lease his animal to a Gentile to do work on Shabbos, because when you lease an animal, you still retain ownership in it, so it's your animal that's doing work on Shabbos, and that would be forbidden. So, lest someone come to actually lease their animal, we forbid even selling these draft animals. But since goats and sheep, little animals, are not used as draft animals, they're not pulling anything, they're not doing malach on Shabbos, so therefore, really, technically, there is no din derabanan not to do it. Nevertheless, some communities have the custom, the minhag, to not even sell small animals, goats and sheep, to Gentiles, lest people come to sell larger animals, which is an iser derabanan, as described before. So therefore, the Mishnah says, Makam shenahagu limkor behema daka la'avad kochavim, if you're residing in a locale where the custom is that one is permitted to sell behema daka, small animals like goats and sheep, to Gentiles, mochern, go ahead and sell them, no problem. Makam shelo nahagu limkor, however, in a place where the custom is not to sell these small animals to Gentiles, in mochern one may not. That is to say, the Mishnah is reinforcing that this minhag is a legitimate minhag. And that's why it's being said over here. We've established the principle already that you have to conform to your local minhagim. But you might have thought that this minhag is actually not even necessarily a legitimate minhag. It's not, doesn't carry the weight of a bona fide minhag. It could just be that some people do, but it's not carrying any further weight than that because it's already like the rationale for it is quite far. It's far from a doraisa. It's only to support a derabban at most, and normally don't make a gezera to a gezera. So the minhag you might thought is not that legitimate. How the Mishnah, however, confers legitimacy and says if there's such a minhag, so then you have to obey it in such a locale. Uvachomakom, at all events, however, the Mishnah will now reinforce that din derabanan of ein mochin lehem behem agasa. One may not sell a Gentile larger animals, meaning cows, horses, and donkeys, because for the reason I explained before, we're concerned they'll end up doing malacha with them on Shabbos, which would be an Isser Doraisa, if the Jew would lease it, and therefore we have a din derabanan, not even to sell it. Now, what about agalim usayachim? What about an egel is a calf, that's a baby cow, and a sayach is a foal, F-O-A-L, which is a baby horse. So, of course, these animals are too small to do work now. So the question is it forbidden also to sell immature livestock to Gentiles, where one for sure knows they won't come through labor with it on Shabbos because they're too small? So the Mishnah says, yes, it's still restricted. Shleiman u'shavurin. It's totally forbidden to sell even baby cows, let alone big ones, and baby horses, let alone big ones. Shleiman, whether they are sound, meaning they're in good shape, or shavurin, or even if they are broken, like they're maimed. So this animal, you know, has three legs or something. It certainly will never be a draft animal. Even so, says this Tana, you can't, as a blanket rule, when the Chazal made the Isra of selling behemagasa, large livestock to Gentiles, they didn't differentiate between immature and mature animals, and they didn't even differentiate between sound and maimed animals. Rabbi Huda mater b'shavur. Rabbi Huda is lenient, and he says, listen, if the animal is a shavura, if the animal is maimed in such a way it will never be a draft animal, there's no reason in the world to restrict it. However, Allah is not like him. And ben b'sera mater b'sus. Ben b'sera is a different idea altogether. Ben b'sera's idea is that when it comes to horses, in truth, no issa d'oraisa is likely to ever happen, even in, like, I'll call it the quote-unquote worst-case scenario, which I'll define as follows. Since our concern is the Gentile will use this animal as a rental, meaning it's still owned by the Jew, and do malacha with it, therefore the Jew is causing his animal to do labor, which is forbidden. So the concern here is that the animal is going to be doing a bona fide Isser d'oraisa. This, of course, going on the person, not the animal. So when it comes to horses, the normal use of a horse is not as a draft animal for pulling, but the Mishnah believes, or Ben Bezerra is believing, that the primary purpose of a horse is for riding on. Now, when a person rides on a horse, so there's a general rule we saw back in Masechet Shabbos, which is the chai is noset atzmo, a human being who's alive, he also helps in supporting his weight because, you know, with his musculature, he adjusts his balance as he's being carried, etc. This expression in English, dead weight, referring to a person who's not adjusting his weight and therefore feels much heavier than a person who's alive and shifting his weight to help. Certainly any parent who's carried his child up the stairs knows you got to tell the kid, you got to lean in, don't lean away from me or I can't get you up the stairs safely, etc. So the leaning and the shifting of the weight assists. And once you have a human being assisting in the carrying, so then it's not done exclusively by the animal or the person or whatever the context is. And that being the case, you're out of Isra D'oraisa territory, just in Isra D'rabbanan territory. And therefore, Ben Becerra holds, when it comes to horses, since horses are used for riding, and when a person rides on an animal that is only Isra D'rabbanan, because riding on your horse as a Jew on Shabbos wouldn't be D'oraisa because you're carrying with it. So therefore, says Ben Becerra, there's no worst case scenario, and therefore it should be permitted to certainly to sell horses to Gentiles, because the worst case scenario of less that comes to leasing isn't a concern of a deraisa. The Tana Kama disagrees with that. He says, listen, horses are used for other things too. They even are used for carrying, let's say, birds. You know, people who are into falconing, they'll, let's say, put their bird on the back of the horse. We actually had a mission like that not too long ago. And in such a scenario, since the bird is not a human being, we don't have the principle of chai noset atzmo, says the Tana Kama. Ben Becerra says you do even by birds, but since Tanakam holds that only a human being could be noset zanso, not an animal. Therefore, there is a doraisa potential of people using their animals to carry livestock, which would be usher. And therefore, the Tana Kama holds you can never sell a horse to a Gentile either. The halacha, as it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch first, is that indeed we do not sell behema gasa, large animals like horses and cows, to Gentiles, period, for the reason as set forth in the Mishnah, as I explained. However, even the Shulchan Aruch acknowledges that the custom has become that Jews do indeed sell their livestock to Gentiles, both large and small livestock, without restriction. And the reason why that might have happened is probably beyond the scope of our Mishnah here, but l'halach l'maisa, the custom certainly is that Jews today do sell livestock, large and small, to Gentiles. Pesachim Perk Dalet, Mishnah Dalet 4:4, another Mishnah about various minhagim, and the truth is we have two separate unrelated minhagim here. The first is the minhag not to eat roasted meat on Seder night. This is referring to time after the Chorban, where there's no Korban Pesach to be brought, and therefore, while the Korban Pesach was eaten roasted over an open fire in a very specific way, which we'll get into in the Masechta shortly, actually, there's a minhag that many people have not to eat any roasted meat outside of the context of the Korban Pesach on Seder night, so people shouldn't think that it's actually a Korban Pesach. And therefore the Mishnah says, "Makom shenagu le'achol tzali," in a place where the custom is to eat roasted foods, belele psachim, ochlin, where it is the custom to eat roasted foods on the night of the Seder, so then it's permitted to do so. Makom shenagu shelo le'achol, however, in a place where the minhag does not eat roasted meats, ein ochlin, one may not eat them. Now, that's the end of that first point here. Just halach lamaisa, the minhag in Ashkenaz, universally Ashkenazim, is to not eat any roasted meat on Leil HaSeder. That includes pot roast, meaning if you put something in like a container but without water and cook it in the oven, that also is forbidden according to the minhag of Ashkenaz, even though that's certainly far from how the Pesach Korban itself was eaten roasted over an open fire, etc. But that is certainly the minhag. It wouldn't apply to things other than meat, meaning not to fish and not to vegetables. Certainly, roasting those is fine. Now, it's as if there's a new Mishnah here. This is totally a new point altogether, a new minhag. We're going to have two different conflicting minhagim here in the next lines of the Mishnah, but they both are driving at the same point. The point is that on Yom Kippur, there are five inuyim, five ways in which one impoverishes his nefesh, his person, so that his neshama can shine on forth. And one of those five is tashmish amita, marital relations, which are forbidden on Yom Kippur. So there are minhagim here to sort of inhibit that from happening, unlike, let's say, a regular Shabbos. So the minhag is, we'll see in the Mishnah, the first minhag is makom shenagu lahadlikas haner b'leili Yom Kippurim madlikin, in a place where the custom is to light a candle on Yom Kippur, then one should do so. We're talking about lighting a candle in the bedroom, and the idea being that because Tashmish is forbidden with the lights on, so that would inhibit people from falling into that. Magmishnagu shlulahadlik, however, in a place where the custom is not to light a candle in the bedroom, so then they don't light it in the whole house, and the whole house stays dark, and that way the men, let's say, coming home from shul wouldn't see their wives and get excited. It's brought down the halacha that the minhag is to have lights on in Yom Kippur in all the rooms, including the bedroom. However, the Mishnah Berurah says there's room to be makel. At all events, madlikin bevati knesios uvati mizrashios. At all events, places where this concern is not relevant, and we certainly do light them up on Yom Kippur, so that means in the base knesses where they daven, and base midrash where they learn, they do have lights burning so people can daven and learn. Uvamavaos hafelim, in dark alleyways, so therefore we need proper lighting for safety, etc., so we do light those up. Valgabi acholim, and similarly with people who are unwell, we have lights going there. Of course, on Yom Kippur you can't light a new candle, like Shabbos, and therefore we need to have lighting in place from before Yom Kippur, so that we can take care of the needs of the sick, etc., should they arise. Psachim, Perek Dalet, Mishnehei, 4-5, one more on Minhagim, unrelated to Pesach. Here we're talking about B'minag of not doing Malacha on Tisha B'Av. Now Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, of course commemorates a number of things. The Mishnah and Tanis brings five things. Most centrally the loss of the Batei HaMikdash, the Beis HaMikdash, and by Sheni specifically. And one is to be in Avelus, in mourning. Now when it comes to proper Avelus, real mourning, meaning for one's relative, so the doing of Malach in general is prohibited. However, the status of the mourning on Tisha B'Av is actually called like an Avelus Yashana, an old mourning, meaning that we're mourning the events of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, which happened long ago, and therefore the intensity is less severe, and although it's important for one to feel the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, the question is whether one really should not work to feel it so strongly. And we see, according to the Mishnah, that there's different menhagim, whether or not to do malacha. We're not talking about a momentary malacha like turning on a light switch, but rather something that would distract your attention, so you'd be mesiach da'as, you would stop focusing on the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore the Mishnah says, Makam shenagu la'asos malacha b'Tisha B'Av, osen, in a locale where the custom is to do malacha on Tisha B'Av day, so then, osen, one may do so. Makum shenagush lola'asos malacha, ein osen. In contrast, in the locale where the custom is not to do malacha on Tisha B'Av, then one may not. This is by force of a minhag, of a custom. V'chomakom, at all events, talmidi chacham b'telim. The Mishnah says that while regular people may or may not refrain from malacha based on local customs, it's proper in all places for talmidi chachamim to refrain from malacha, because they should be, or they ought to be, trying to be in distress over the Beis HaMikdash, and that being the case, it's improper for them to do malacha anywhere. Now, if you're a Talmid Chacham and you're acting in a way which is in contrast to what the rest of the community is doing, that would not be so uncommon. In many ways, Talmid Chacham, like for example, Tumah Tahara, are known to act differently than everyone else, and that's perfectly fine. The question is, what if a person isn't yet a Talmud Chacham? So while it's clear if you know who you are, what if you're not there yet, but you want to conduct yourself like a Talmud Chacham to feel, or to try to feel, the intense avelus of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash? So, according to Tanna Kamma, you would not be allowed to refrain from malacha if you're not a Talmud Chacham in a place where they indeed do malacha. The reason being because that would be called mechsi kayura. You would appear arrogant in the eyes of others, and that is, since arrogance is the worst of all midos, we don't want someone to inculcate that, or even to have a hint of such a mida. Therefore, it's improper for a person to refrain from malacha and ascribe to himself the status as if he were a talmid chacham, when in fact he's not. However, Rabban Shimon Gamliel Omer, La'olam ya'asa adam atzmo talmid chacham. Rabban Shimon Gamliel says anybody who wants to can take on such a custom and comport himself as if he were a talmid chacham, at least with respect to the halachas of not working on Tisha B'Av. So Rabban Shimon Gamliel says that's going to be fine, and he doesn't think there's a mechsi kura issue problem here, either because he doesn't concern himself with mechsi kura, and you'll notice that will be in contrast to what he said back in Brachas, if you recall back there, regarding saying Kriyishma on the night of one's wedding, etc. Or here, Rabban Shimon Gamliel says it's not an issue of yura, of mechsik yura, of appearing arrogant, because a person is not doing malacha on Tisha B'Av, he's not standing out. He's just not doing malacha. No one will look at him and say, how come he's not working harder? Maybe he has nothing to do. There's plenty of people who have nothing to do. So he'd have nothing to do also, perhaps, and therefore it wouldn't constitute appearing arrogant. Therefore, he says it's appropriate. One who wants to do so may. Now, at all events, the halacha l'maisa is that the halacha l'maisa is like the Tanna Kamma, meaning that one may do malacha in a place where the custom is to do so. The Shulchan Aruch definitely says that one who wants to act like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel may act as such. And the Gemara in Tainus even says, to the contrary, one who does Malacha on Tisha B'Av will see no Siman Bracha from it, he'll gain nothing from it. So one certainly could do that if he wants to. Halacha Lamais Lamais, when it comes to Ashkenazim, the Ramah paskins that there's a universal minhag for us not to do Malacha in the first half of the day of Tisha B'Av, up to Chatzos. And at that time would be permitted, excuse me, forbidden to do so, halacha l'maisa for us, to do things that distract you from the morning, and the afternoon it becomes permitted again. Now, period. New paragraph. The Mishnah now returns back to an old topic, the topic of the first Mishnah of our parak. We started out by talking about doing malacha on Erev Pesach. And there we said that while the second half of the day is certainly, it's forbidden to do malacha, it's like a quasi-holiday, like kind of like Chol HaMoed. But the first half of the day was subject to various minhagim. And we said in the first mission there, you have to conduct yourself according to local minhag. Now, here our mission, according to Bartzner, will disagree with that. And it will say that there's actually specific dinim lehalacha midirabanan, whether or not one may do malacha on Erev Pesach. And the mission says, Chacham Omrim b'Yehuda, in Yehuda, that's, I'll call it the southern part of Israel, hayu osin malacha ba'arvei psachim ad chatzos. They would indeed do malacha in the first half of the day until chatzos. Uva Galil, however, in the Galil, that we'll call the northern part of Israel, lo hayu osin kol ikar. They would not do any malacha on Erev Pesach by force of a din to rabbanon, meaning it's not just a minhag. There'd be nafkaminis for that if it's by force of a minhag versus of a din derabanan. Like, for example, if a person starts out in the Galil and then moved to Yehuda, so in the Galil it was forbidden to do malacha the first half of the day, and in the Galil it's permitted. If it was a matter of minhag only, so we said you have to keep the minhag of where you came from and where you are, so that would be true. So the guy from the Galil going to Yehuda would have to would not be allowed to do malacha based on his old minhag. However, if a person moved from the Galil to Yehuda and did not intend to return to the Galil, so now he's got a new home, and he would take on the minhagim of his local, his new home, and leave those old minhagim, meaning now it would become permitted for him to do malacha in Yehuda on Erev Pesach. However, that's only if it's by force of a minhag, then you take on the new minhagim when you move. However, if it were by force of an actual din derabanan, so changing location doesn't change things, and therefore, if the din is a din derabanan, the people of Galil who relocate to Yehuda would still be forbidden to do malacha, even in Yehuda, even with the minhag over there, as yes, do it, because from their perspective, it's aser min derabanan to do malacha on Erev Pesach. That would be a big nafkamina, according to our Mishnah, if it were a din derabanan or simply a minhag. Now, the question is now, in Yehuda, excuse me, in the Galil, where they're not doing malacha the whole day on Erev Pesach, what about the night before? Usually in Jewish law, the day begins the night before. And therefore, the Mishnah says, V'halayla, as for the night before, Beishamai Osrin. Beishamai says, yes, the minhag is indeed, or the halacha is indeed, in the Galil, that one may not do malacha even on the preceding night, meaning from the night of Bedikas Chametz onwards. However, Ubeis Hillel Matirin Ad HaNeitzach Chama. Beis Hillel say no. It's not like a normal all-day Yom Tov, if you will. Rather, it's something comparable to a fast day. And on a normal fast day, like, say, whatever, Tanis Esther or the 17th of Tammuz, 10th of Tevis, etc. So the fast only begins in the morning. It doesn't begin the night before. And that being the case, similarly, Beis Hillel say the restriction on working only kicks in even where it's forbidden to work on Erev Pesach from the day. Now, FYI, when it comes to normal daytime things, like the daytime fast, for example, La'alacha, it begins from Alos HaShachar, which is first light, which occurs about 72 minutes, let's say, before Netzachama, before sunrise. Netzachama is like when the sun appears on the horizon, and it starts getting light long before that. And La'alacha day begins at the first light, not at the actual sunrise. The reason why here it's more lenient is because, in general, people don't go out to work until sunrise. They're not going to out to doing work earlier than that, typically, and therefore when they made this din derabanan of restricting doing work on the first half of the day of Erev Pesach, they didn't do it prior to Netzach Chama, because that wasn't a normal thing for people to do, and therefore they didn't make any din derabanan against it. Psachim Perek Daled, Mishnah Vav 4:6, we had said that there are certain places where one is not allowed to do malacha on Erev Pesach, even on the first half of the day. Here we have some leniencies for those places, and we're specifically going to be talking about places, again, where the minhag or the din is not to do malacha on the first half of Erev Pesach. And as we'll see in a moment, these are leniencies where you're doing something for the sake of the moed, dafka, something that you need for Pesach. So the Mishnah says, Reb Meir Omer, kol malacha shehischil ba kodem la'arba asar, any work that you began, any construction project, making, you know, creative project that you did, and you started it prior to the 14th, then gomra, you're allowed to finish it ba'arba asar, on the 14th in the morning. Again, meaning in a place where one is not allowed to do malacha on the first half of the 14th, one could still finish a job you started from before. And again, that's provided that what we're talking about is something that you need for the moed, for the Yom Tov of Pesach. Aval lo yaschil ba, however, one may not begin a project anew, but techila, from the outset, bar ba'asar, on the morning of the 14th, again, in a place where it's otherwise forbidden to do malach on the first half of the day, even if it's something for that you need for Pesach, afal pi sheyachol gomra, even if it's true that you could finish the job still before Chatzos, before midday, when it becomes forbidden to do malacha on Erev Pesach. The Chacham are going to give even a further leniency, and they're going to say there are certain scenarios where, even where it's forbidden to do malacha on the first half of Pesach, even where you didn't start the job before the 14th of Pesach, you still could start and finish something on the morning of the 14th, in three different areas. The Chacham Omrim, Shalosh Umnios, there are three different areas of crafts, you know. Osin Malacha Ba'arve Pesachim Ad Chatzos, where one could do Malacha on Erev Pesach until midday, even though otherwise things would be forbidden in such a place. Again, provided you're doing it for the sake of the Moed, Ve'eluhen, and these are them. All three of these things are going to be Malachas where there is a built-in leniency in the Lacha even during Chol HaMoed. And since we're talking about something you need for the moed, and see these things already have some leniency built in during Chol HaMoed itself, so for sure on Erev Pesach, which is similar but actually a little bit more lenient than Chol HaMoed proper, it should be permitted to do these things on Erev Pesach. We're learning from those precedents that leniency is on Pesach, Chol HaMoed itself. The first is Hachayatim, tailors. There's a din, Lahalach Lamaisa, that if one is in Chol HaMoed and he needs to do some sewing, tailoring work, on Chol HaMoed, if he is a hediot, meaning someone who's not a professional tailor, meaning someone who can't like sew a hem in a straight line, for argument's sake, so then such a person is allowed to do his sewing on Chol HaMoed without a shinui, and meaning he can sew in his normal, best, usual way. Normally when it comes to doing malacha on Chol HaMoed, even where it's permitted, one has to do it with a shinui in an unusual way. But when it comes to tailoring, sewing, if one's a non-professional, a hediot, one could do it in a normal way. So that's a precedent where tailoring on Chol HaMoed is more lenient than other malachas. And that being the case, we'll have a precedent that before Pesach begins, one could be more lenient yet. And even in a place where it's forbidden to do malacha on the first half of the day in Erev Pesach, one could do sewing for the sake of the moed. Vahasaparim, same goes for hair cutting. A sapar is a barber. So the rule is that when it comes to getting a haircut, one may not do it in Chol HaMoed. One should go into the Yom Tov already being neatly groomed. However, if one was only let out of prison during Chol HaMoed, he's permitted to get a haircut. Of course, he couldn't groom himself properly before the Yom Tov because he was in prison. And that being the case, since we see there's a precedent for allowing someone in Chol HaMoed to get a conventional haircut, we'll be lenient and say getting a conventional haircut on Erev Pesach is permitted, even where otherwise malach is forbidden on the first half of the day. V'hakovsin, and the exact same thing applies for launderers, meaning to launder to clean clothing, because someone who came out of prison could launder his clothes during Chol HaMoed. That's a precedent that says that one could launder clothing on Erev Pesach, the first half of the day, for the sake of the moed, even where it's otherwise forbidden to do malach. So those are the three lenient areas. Now, Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda wants to add a fourth. He says, Af haritza'anim, so too for sandal makers. A ritzua is a strap, so people who do the leather work for shoes. Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda's thought is, we have a precedent that there's a leniency that for the Ole Regel, the pilgrims who come to Yerushalayim, so they come from a great distance and their shoes often wear out on the way and they break, and it's permitted during Chol Moed to repair the shoes, to reattach straps that broke, etc. So he suggests that since you can do that kind of leather working on Chol HaMoed, that should be a present that should say you should be able to do leather working to make shoes on Erev Pesach, even when it's otherwise forbidden, if you need those shoes for Pesach itself. However, the Chacham disagree to that. They reject that because they say you can't learn from repairing a broken sandal out of necessity in Chol HaMoed to creating a sandal anew. They're not the same thing. And in the case of the Chacham reject that shita, and fine. So the halacha therefore goes like the Chachamim, meaning not like Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda, that these three are lenient even in a place where it's otherwise forbidden to do malacha on Erev Pesach. Perek Dalet Mishnah Zayin 4:7 and more on work done on the 14th of Nisan, Erev Pesach. Moshivin Shovachin LeTarnegolim Ba'arba Asar. One can arrange for the chickens to properly incubate the eggs on the 14th. That means putting eggs under chickens or chickens atop eggs, as the case may be. And that's permitted throughout the whole day of the 14th, even after Chatzos. The reason why is because that's not considered a malacha at all. V'tarnagola shebarcha, if you have a chicken who ran away, that means you had an egg that was being incubated, and it's been incubated already for 3 days, which means that the egg now has a gestating chicken inside of it, and it can't be eaten anymore as an egg. So if you don't put a chicken back on it, the egg is going to go to waste. It's inedible, unusable, and therefore it's a dover avid, something which is going to cause kind of irreparable loss, even though it's not a very material loss, but it's a loss. So the din is that machazir nosalim koma, you're allowed to bring that chicken and chase it back to get back on the egg. That's true even during Chol HaMoed. That's a little strange, as much as the Mishnah is talking about work on the 14th, but the Gemara makes it clear that since you're allowed to arrange for chickens to be on eggs lechachila from the outset, before Pesach begins on the 14th, for sure you could chase a chicken back that went away. So the point here, the Mishnah is even during Chol HaMoed, it's mutter to do so. Again, we're talking about a scenario of Davar Avid, which means actually both A, the eggs have been incubated for 3 days, and therefore if you don't further incubate them, it's a total loss, and B, that the chicken hasn't been off for 3 days, meaning at that point the incubated egg will be sort of spoiled, and it's a loss anyways. V'imesa, if the chicken that had been sitting on the eggs dies, moshivan acheres tachta, one can replace the dead chicken with a living chicken. Same with the idea. Again, we're assuming that we're talking about that the eggs have incubated already, and we're talking about a dover avid, a loss that would otherwise occur. And that again means that this would be permitted to do even on Chol HaMoed, again assuming that by putting a new chicken on, although it's a bit of work, it would save the eggs from otherwise being lost entirely. Furthermore, gorfin mitachas ragli behema ba'arba asar, one is permitted to rake the manure from beneath the feet of the livestock on the 14th. That's again permitted throughout the whole day of the 14th, not considered to be a forbidden malacha. To the contrary, it's considered to be something akin to cleaning one's house and readying the home for the onset of Yom Tov, so that would include cleaning out the animal stalls, and that's permitted, meaning one could clean them out on the 14th and also schlep the manure out to like the refuse pile outside of the chatzer, outside of one's home and living area. The point being that to actually drag that manure, which is fairly heavy, is labor intensive, and therefore you might think it's disallowed. And in fact, as we'll see in a moment, it is disallowed during Chol HaMoed, but on the 14th, it is yes permitted. But Uva Moed, when it comes to Chol HaMoed itself, so now because of the labor involved in dragging the refuse to a dumping area outside of one's chatzer where one lives, you may not do that, but rather Misalkin Litzadin, you're allowed to push the refuse aside. So you push it to the sides of the pen where the animal is living, and that way the animal doesn't have to stand inside its refuse and dirty its food, etc. That's permitted in Chol HaMoed, but more than that, to actually take the refuse out of the pen to elsewhere is considered to be tirchi asera, excessive labor, and therefore disallowed in Chol HaMoed. Finally, molichin mevi'in kelim mebeis ha'uman. One is permitted to bring utensils to and from the craftsman on the 14th, and that's true afopi she'enem letzorach hamoed, even if we're talking about utensils that are not needed for Pesach. It's not a malach at all to go and do errands on the 14th and drop stuff off, even to get fixed or repaired or whatever it is that's permitted on the 14th. It's not malach at all. During Chol HaMoed, however, this would be restricted, and one would not be allowed to go and fetch something from the craftsman, from his warehouse or shop, unless it was for something that one needed on Pesach itself, then it would be permitted to go and retrieve it. Psachim, Perek Daled, Mishnah Ches, 4:8. The Mishnah is going to list now six things that the people of Jericho did that the Chazal, the rabbis, did not agree with. The first of them has to do with work on Erev Pesach, and that's why it's featured here. But we'll discuss a number of things. What's important to realize here is we're going to say that they did six things, all of which the rabbis disagreed with. However, three of them, they gave them some formal censure. They were michu b'yadam. They protested formally their actions. And three of them, they didn't. They let those things slide. So the Mishnah says, Shisha devarim asu anshei Yericho. There were six things that the people of Jericho did. Al shlosha michu b'yadam. For three of them, the Chachamim formally censured them. They give reproof. Va'al shlosha lo michu b'yadam. The other three, notwithstanding the fact that the rabbis disagreed with what they did, the rabbis did not formally reprove them. Ve'eluhen. And these are those shlo michu b'yadam, that the rabbis did not formally censure them. The first is markivin dekalim kol hayom. On the day before Pesach, the 14th of Nisan, even after Chatzos, when labor is forbidden, the people of Jericho would graft date trees. Date trees there basically came in two varieties, one which bore fruit and one which didn't bear fruit. And what they would do is they would graft onto the stalk of a non-bearing fruit tree, a scion, like a branch, let's call it, of a fruit-bearing date palm, and that would make a plant that would give fruit. So they did that even after Chatzos. Their concern was that this was like a dover of it, a thing that they would cause them a great loss otherwise, because it was obviously a time, particular timing issue with regards to the seasons and the setting up of these date palms, and dates were a central feature, a central part of their diet. So since they reasoned it was a dover of it, and we would be permitted to do even on Chol HaMoed, for sure it would be permitted to do even on the 14th in the afternoon. And while the rabbis didn't necessarily agree with that, well, they didn't agree with that rationale, they thought the rationale was sufficient to not demand that the Chacham make a formal censure of their activities. The second thing, and now we move away from Pesach to other topics, is v'chorchin. Koreach is like a sandwich, like korach, the korach of Pesach Seder, in other words, of a kricha is like a wrap. So they would combine es hashma. Excuse me, korchin es shma. They would like bundle up the kriya shma together. The point here is that after they said the first pasuk kriya shma, either they two pshat in the Bar Tanur brings, either they didn't say Bruch Shem Kavod, or they didn't wait sufficiently after the saying of Echad. So both things in turn, I'll explain briefly. When Moshe Rabbeinu in Veschanan writes the Shema, so the pasuk of Shema and the second pasuk of Ve'ahavta follow back to back. However, back in Bereshis, when Yaakov Avinu was nearing his death, he called his sons to sit around him, and he intended to reveal to them what would happen in the future and the event of the end of time, when that would be. And at that point, the Shekhinah left him because it didn't want the revelation to come out about when Mashiach HaZeder would come. And Yaakov Avinu was concerned that the Shekhinah leaving him was because there was some problem with one of his, or more than one of his children, in terms of their emunah, etc. So when he was concerned about that, the children responded, meaning the Shifteka, the 12 children of Yaakov, told him in unison, Shema Yisrael. Yisrael was Yaakov Avinu's name. Listen, Father Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We are all agreeing in our minds to the fidelity to the same one God as you, and there's no reason to be concerned about us having some kind of psul, some kind of, you know, inadequacy in terms of emunah, etc. And in relief to that, Yaakov Avinu responded by saying, Baruch Shem Kavod, Malchus Leilam Voed, which is, he blessed Hashem, and hope expresses hope that Hashem's reign, expression of his reign, would be manifest forever here in Olam Hazeh. So the Chazal in the Gemara here in Pesachim say that the rabbis were in a bit of a conundrum what to do. They didn't want to insert the Baruch Shem Kavod verse, if you will, after Shema before Vahavta, because that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu did. On the other hand, it is what Yaakov Avinu did. So the resolution was to insert Baruch Shem Kavod, but only in a whisper. And of course, that's what we do, Bizman Hazeh. We whisper Baruch Shem Kavod. But the people of Yericho didn't do that. They just skipped the Baruch Shem Kavod, and the rabbis didn't like it, but they didn't formally make a macha, a censure. The other pshat in the Bar Tanura is that after they said the word Echad of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, so the proper thing to do is that one should be ma'arich, should protract the articulation of the Dalit sound, and we actually can't do that anymore because the way Ashkenazim and Sephardim today pronounce the Dalit like the letter D, there's no way really to extend it out. But the original pronunciation of the Dalit without the dot in it has some, like something like a th sound, and because of that, that would allow Echad to be extended out, and that's the din. Nowadays, we slightly protract the pronunciation of Echad, but the point is we pause for a moment after saying Echad to contemplate and accept upon ourselves the Malchus, the sovereignty of Hashem over the whole world and over ourselves. That takes a moment, so we have to pause for a moment to accept that upon ourselves before going on to the next pasuk referring to the expression and the mitzvah to love Hashem. So that takes a moment. You have to pause and think about that and be mamlech Hashem. And the people of Yericho didn't do that. According to the second pshat in the Bar Tanura, they just rushed through like a sandwich. They just kind of bundled it all together. And that was not satisfactory as a minhag, but nevertheless, the rabbis didn't make a formal censure of it. And the third thing that they did was v'kotzrin v'gotzrin lefnei ha'omer. They would kotzer, which is to reap grain, v'gotzrin, and they would stack the grain and pile up the grain into a gadish, into like a pile, a haystack, or you know, a grain stack, lefnei ha'omer, prior to the offering of the korban ha'omer, which was done on the 16th of Nisan, meaning the first day of Chol HaMoed, of Pesach. So this is referring to the fact that there's a din that Chadash, the new year's grain crop, is forbidden for consumption until after the Omer is brought, or Bizman Hazeh without a korban Omer being brought. At least it's restricted as Chadash until the 16th of Nisan. Now, Midrabanan, the rabbi said, even in a place where they wouldn't be collecting the Omer, because the truth is you're actually not allowed to even harvest grain prior to the bringing of the Omer where that grain could have been used for the Omer, but even in a place where you're too far from Jerusalem to even think about bringing that grain as the Omer, still, Midrabban, they said, even if you're going to harvest it, you shouldn't stack, meaning pile the grain, until after the Omer is brought, lest you get distracted and come to eat the grain. So it's a din d'rabbanan not to pile the grain up before bringing the Omer. And the people of Yericho ignored that din d'rabbanan, and they piled their grain up anyways. And that was objectionable to the rabbis, but they actually made no formal objection. In all three of those cases, therefore, v'lo michu bi'adam, the rabbi didn't express a formal complaint or protest to the people of Yericho. On the other hand, v'elu shemichu bi'adam, the following three things that they did were sufficiently objectionable that the rabbis actually did make a formal macha, a censure of what they did. The first is, matirin gamzios shel hekdesh. They permitted the growths of hekdesh, of consecrated trees. The story here is that there were certain trees that were being chopped down by robbers, and the way they would preempt that from happening is by being makdishem to dedicate the tree to the base of Mikdash. Yes, it's fabulously ironic that the thieves of yesteryear wouldn't steal the trees if they were the base of Mikdash's trees, just their private people's trees. But that seems to be the case, as the Gemara describes it. So, once you're makdish something, you give it to the base of Mikdash, and it's hekdesh, it's base of Mikdash property, so getting benefit from such a thing is forbidden to misappropriate sanctified anything, actually, anything that's sanctified at the Beis Hamikdash is called Me'ilah. And if one does an act of Me'ilah, so he has to bring an Asham Me'ilos, a guilt offering for doing Me'ilah, as well as replace what he stole, and being Mosef Chomesh, add an extra 25% surcharge. That only applies, however, to things that actually were consecrated. If you consecrate a tree, and then after that, new apples grow on the tree, or new branches grow on the tree, so then, technically, if one were to eat the apple or the branch, so then he would not be committing an act of Me'ilah, because it wasn't the apple or the branch that was sanctified, but only the tree itself. So there are two pshatim exactly what they did, whether it's taking the branches or taking the apples, so to speak, the fruit from the tree. Either way, the point is that they reasoned that since it's not Me'ilah, it would be permitted to take the growths from the tree. However, there's an Isser Durabanan of getting benefit even from the growths from such a tree, and therefore the rabbis didn't like what they did and actually formally protested that. Second of all, V'ochlin metachas ha'nisharim b'shabbos. Literally the words here mean, and they ate from beneath, and then it doesn't say what they were eating or what they were beneath, hanoshim, that fell, b'shabbos, on Shabbos. So the missing words here are that they ate beneath the fruit trees from the fruit that fell from those trees, and they ate that fruit on Shabbos. Okay, that's what the words literally mean. The case is, we're talking about fruit that falls from a tree. So if the fruit fell from the tree from before Shabbos, so then the fruit is totally edible, there's no mukta issue, because when Shabbos came in already, it was edible as fruit. That's fine. There is an issue of gathering fruit from beneath a tree, but this is not, that's called the ma'amer, it's a malach all to itself on Shabbos. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about just simply sitting under an apple tree and picking up an apple off the ground and eating it. So if it fell before Shabbos, so then it's not a problem. Everyone agrees you could eat that apple. If it fell after Shabbos came in, everyone agrees that apple is a muktzah. The reason why is because when Shabbos came in, it wasn't ready for consumption. You can't pick apples from trees on Shabbos. Therefore, the apple was not ready for human consumption. And therefore, now that it becomes available on Shabbos, it's a new thing, which is muktzah. It wasn't set aside for use on Shabbos before Shabbos came in. Fine. And the people of Yericho agree to that also. The contentious point is, what happens if you don't know whether the apple fell before Shabbos came in or after Shabbos came in? So then it's a suffix, it's a doubtful apple. Maybe it's muktzah, maybe it isn't. And the people of Yericho reasoned that since the halacha of muktzah is only a rabbinic enactment, it's a din derabbanan, and the overriding rule that applies to derabbanans is suffix derabbanan lahakel. One can be lenient in a doubtful case that involves, at worst, a violation of a rabbinic halacha. So they said, listen, these apples may have fallen on Shabbos, they may have fallen before Shabbos. Either way, we don't know, but that makes them maybe muktzah, but it's a suffix derabbanan, and therefore we should be able to lean into and eat from these apples. The rabbis, however, disagreed with that. And they said, no, when it comes to muktzah, so we don't have the rule of suffix derabbanan lahakel. We have to go l'chumra, we have to be machmir when it comes to a suffix of muktzah. The reason why is one of two possibilities. Either A, because they basically built the halacha of muktzah based on a pasuk. It's certainly a din derabbanan, but it's like they were so machet, it's a smach that's like based on a pasuk on some level, and that would be enough to make it be like they wanted to follow the pattern of a deraisa, meaning a suffix mukta, which will be aser. The second approach is that if it's a davar shesh lo matiren, which means if it's the kind of thing which if you wait around, there's a way that you can eat it in a permitted way, which certainly is the case when it comes to suffix mukta. Of an apple, because when Shabbos is over, the muktzah issue is no longer an issue, and therefore the apple's edible. So in such a scenario of Devarim Shesh L'Matirim, they were machmir, strict, and said, so long as it's a suffix muktzah, you have to wait, and you can't eat it even on Shabbos. Whatever the lamdas is, the rabbis did not agree with the rationale of the Anshei Yericho, the Jericho residents, and therefore they formally protested. And finally, V'nosnim pe'a liyarek. The people of Jericho would leave Peah, that means the gift, the unharvested corner of the field, a gift to the poor of Peah, even for vegetables. And the rationale was that, what's the problem? You'd say, listen, leaving extra fruits for the vegetables vegetables to the poor people is a mitzvah. It's great. So why would they have an objection to that? The answer is that when you leave something as peah, so it's exempt from trumas amisras, the various tithes that are given to the Kohanim and Levium. And if you call something peah, but really it isn't legally peah, so then really, while you might be doing it as a gift to the poor, when you give a gift to the poor, that gift is subjected to the hafrashas, the taking of trumas amisras, and the poor of Jericho were misled into thinking that the vegetables that they're collecting as so-called peah were actually not peah. They were just gifts, and therefore the poor people were not taking the proper truma samaisos as they should be, and eating food that has enough truma taken from it is very not kosher. The penalty is misa b'dei shemayim, premature death. It's worse than eating bacon, so that's bad news. And therefore the rabbis they objected strongly to this practice. What were the people of Jericho thinking? So there are five conditions for produce to be eligible for or required to be left, have pay left from it, which include that it's edible, it's cultivated as food, it's protected as opposed to being left as hefker, ownerless, it draws nourishment from the ground, as opposed to, like a mushroom, which isn't a plant, it eats up that decaying material, that it's lekita suka achas, it's all harvested at the same time, one single harvest, as opposed to, say, like figs, which ripen on the tree over the course of the whole summer. And finally, machniso lekiyum, that when you collect it, it can be kept in storage for a while. It can store and last. And when it comes to certain vegetables, that's like a beet. So the people eat the beet root. That's like the bulb at the bottom. We call beets in English. Typically Americans call it that, as opposed to beet roots, like they call it in other places. And also they eat the beet leaves. Now the beet leaves certainly are not, they're not machnis and lakiyum. They would, wilt and become dried out and horrible very quickly. Nevertheless, since the beet leaves are attached to the beet root, the people of Jericho thought you could leave peah and must leave peah on the beets, even the leaves. And they were wrong, say the Chachamim, but they did it anyways, and they caused this problem of the poor people, and therefore the rabbis did umichu biyadim Chachamim, the rabbis did lodge a formal complaint against the people of Yericho for that, as well as the other two practices. Psachim, Perek Dalet, Mishnah Tess, 4-9, and the last Mishnah of the Perek. And in fact, this is actually probably not a Mishnah originally. This is probably a Tosefta. In the Gemara, you'll see it's not a separate Mishnah, and the Rambam says as much, but he felt that this Tosefta, which is an addition to a Mishnah, which is brought in the Gemara over here, contains some very important Hashkafic lessons, and therefore the Rambam in the Perish Mishnayos gives an explanation, a commentary on this Brisa, and that been the case, even though originally was a Tosefta, Brisa Tosefta, let's call them synonymous for now, it ended up being later on included in the Mishnah proper. So here we have it. It says, and it's structurally, of course, similar to the previous Mishnah, because it says, Shisha Devarim Asa Chizkiyahu HaMelech. There were six things that Chizkiyahu HaMelech, King Hezekiah, did. Similar to the way in the previous mission we had, there were six things that the people of Yericho did. Ashlosha hodulo, there were three of these six things which the rabbis agreed with Chizkiyah's actions. Vashlosha lo hodulo, and on three other ones, the rabbis didn't agree with what he did. Meaning he did all six things, but in three of them, the rabbis just didn't agree. Just to make sure it's clear, in the previous Mishnah, we had six things being done in Yericho. All six were not with the approval of the rabbis, but three of them had explicit disapproval expressed. Here in our Mishnah, we have three things that the rabbis actually, yes, approved of, and three that they didn't. And here they are. The first of the three that they did agree about was Gerer Atzamos Aviv Almita Shel Chavalim. After the death of King Ahaz, the father of Chizkiyahu, who was the 12th king of Yehuda, Chizkiyahu became the king, he's the 13th king of Yehuda, and as part of the burial, Chizkiyahu buried his father Ahaz in a conventional way. He transported the corpse on like a rope stretcher as opposed to like a fancy bier that one might use for the burial of a king, because Ahaz was a rasha. He was a terrible person, and he brought a great deal of idolatry of Avodah Zarah to Klal Yisrael. Chizkiyahu, in contrast, was a big tzaddik, a great king, and both to effect some kind of kapara for his father, and also to do a Kiddush Hashem and let people know just how terrible his father was and Avodah Zarah is, he gave him what is a relatively speaking disgraceful burial, as much as he's buried like a common man. If you'll ask what's with Kibud Av, the obligation of honoring one's parents, so first of all, you should know that the mitzvah of Kibud Av Ve'em applies both during the lifetime of your parents as well as after their death. However, the question is, does the mitzvah of Kibud Av apply when one's father is a Rasha? So that's actually Machlokas Rishonim. Rashi says, no, it doesn't. The Rambam and others say, yes, it does. But at all events, after the death of a parent who was a Rasha, there's no longer a mitzvah of Kibud Av, or Aim. And that being the case over here, Chizkiyahu did what he did without concerning himself with the mitzvah of Kibud Av. And Vahodalo, the rabbis were in agreement that that was a great thing to do, to send a very powerful, important message to Klal Yisrael. Second of all, Hikitas Nachash HaNachoshes, he ground up the Nachash HaNachoshes, that copper serpent. You recall back to Parshas Chukas, the Jews were complaining about Moshe and the food and water, and the man wasn't good enough for them, and Hashem sent these fiery serpents to attack the Jewish people, staving off the plague happened, but then to heal themselves, they needed to look at this. Hashem told Moshe to create this Nachash and Nachoshes, this like kind of copper snake that was put on a pole for them to look at, and by looking at the snake, they'd be healed. The truth is that Nachoshes probably best translated as bronze, but bronze is based as copper and there's a bit of tin added, so probably much of the same, probably both mean the same thing. I mean, excuse me, the word Nachoshes means both copper as well as bronze. Now, what had happened was that Nachash and Nachoshes, the Nachushtan, this copper serpent, was left since Moshe's time, but people were bringing it offerings, like bringing, you know, incense offerings to it, treating it as an idol, and therefore Chizkiyahu thought it was inappropriate, and he it certainly wasn't appropriate, of course, and therefore he saw fit to actually grind it up and get rid of the Nachash and Nachoshes, and the rabbis Vahodalo, they agreed. If you'll ask, well, once it's been served as an idol, there's actually a mitzvah midoraisa to destroy idols, so why wouldn't that apply to Nachash and Nachoshes? And the answer is that the people who were doing the Avodah Zarah, didn't have the right to turn it into an idol per se, meaning if you have a car in your driveway and I bow down to your car as my car god, whatever it is, so to speak, that wouldn't make your car now liable for destruction because I have no right to turn your car into an idol. It's your car, not mine. Similarly, people bowing down to an idol that isn't a statue that isn't theirs wouldn't make it forbidden. But nevertheless, Chizkiyahu sought to get rid of it, and that was the betterment of society, and the rabbis agreed. And the third thing is Ganaz Sefer Refuos Vahodulo. There was the Book of Healing, Sefer Refuos, which is already written by Shlomo Melech, King Solomon, and in it contained the medical remedies to all sorts of maladies. So how to heal yourself, get instant healing from whatever was ailing you. And people were going to the book and using it to get sort of instant healing, and therefore not needing to respond to the fact that they were unwell, which was the purpose why Hashem sent them the illness in the first place. So they weren't doing tshuva, they were just kind of taking, you know, two pills and getting all better, whatever their recipe for the healing was. So Chizkiyahu thought that was not good. He thought that it would be much better. People should be unwell and then have to respond to their unwellness by doing tshuva and returning to Hashem. And they were losing that opportunity by having sort of an instant fix. And that being the case, he was gonez. He hid away this book. Geniza would imply, has a connotation that it will come back one day. It's just sort of in safekeeping for now. That's how most, like Rashi, most learn it. The Rambam strongly objects to that pshat. He says there's certainly nothing wrong with going to the doctor and getting healed, and nothing wrong at all with that. And the same way a person, you know, eats food every day and recognizes that without the food, he would be in big trouble, but he understands Hashem provides him the food. He thanks Hashem for the food, and that doesn't make him have less bitachon, etc. So too, a person can get healed with medication or medical treatment, and that should not necessarily impede on his bitachon. So the Rambam disagrees strongly. The Rambam explains that what's going on here is this book was like an occult book, and although it was nonsense, didn't actually have any, the remedies prescribed by the book were certainly not efficacious. that the pictures in them was they was kept around so that the rabbis could understand what different like occult, you know, Avodah Zarah type things were going on and what was the Avodah Zarah behind these different practices. So it's sort of like an educational manual, if you will, on what not to do, when they needed to know that. But nevertheless, since people were doing these remedies and turning to the occult, which is certainly forbidden in Jewish law, Chizkiyahu destroyed the book. Or excuse me, hid away the book. And that's how the Rambam understands it. Okay, so those are the three things that he did that they did, yes, agree to. But Ashlo, Shalo, Hodulo, there are another three things that they did not agree with Chizkiyahu. The first is Kitzas Delasos Shel Heichel, the Shigran Lamelech Ashur. Chizkiyahu cut off the doors, the golden doors of the Heichel, of the sanctuary, of the temple, in the temple complex, and he sent them to the king of Assyria. The story here is that there was the Assyrians, actually under Sargon the II, not the same as the Akkadian Sumerian Sargon from 1500 years before that, whatever it is, in like the year 721, 22, 23, he conquered the northern half of Israel and took, that's the 10 lost tribes story. He did not succeed in taking the southern half. Later on, he did besiege Yehuda, the southern half. While he did capture Lachish, etc., he was not successful in taking Yerushalayim. Now, in anticipation of that siege, a great number of things were done. The building of the broad wall, which you can see in the Old City today, by the post office in the Old City, etc., just outside the square. And he also did some other things we'll talk about in a moment. But the end of the day is the Navi Yeshaya said not to worry, Hashem would protect the Jews of Jerusalem. Ultimately, that is what happened, and there was a plague that beset the Assyrians, and they had to leave their siege without having conquered or even shot an arrow at Yerushalayim. But be that as it may, under Sennacherib, who took over from Sargon, like I said, this is like the year like 701 BCE, something like that, he did levy taxes on the people in Yehuda, and there was a heavy tax, and they didn't have enough silver in the treasuries to meet the tax requirements, and therefore, instead of, as the rabbis wanted Chizkiyahu to do, being confident he'd find the money from somewhere, whatever the story is, he actually cut the golden doors off the base of Mikdash to send them as part of this tribute and tax to Melech Ashur Sennacherib, and the rabbis did not agree to that one bit, but he did it anyways. Second, they didn't agree to that. The second thing that he did they didn't agree with is Sasam Me Gichon Ha'elyon. He stuffed up the upper Gichon spring. The story is that there's a natural spring, the Gichon, which provides water to Yerushalayim. You'll note that most ancient cities are on some natural water source. Jerusalem, in the middle of the desert, it doesn't have a river or whatever it is, but it does have a spring, the Gichon spring. You can still see, if you go into what they are called Chizkiyahu's tunnels today, you can see the tunnel that Chizkiyahu made to access that spring. But he stopped up the upper part of the Gichon so that the Assyrians who were besieging the city from outside wouldn't have access to water. And although that did mess up the water supply, and the rabbis therefore were opposed to it, Chizkiyahu felt it was important to protect the city from the siege. So that's what he did. Belohodlo, what they did not agree. And the third thing is Iber Nisan ben Nisan. He added an extra month. The English word for that is intercalate. But the point is that as I'm sure you know, the Jewish year is required to stay in line with the solar cycle because Chodesh Ha'aviv is the springtime, what's translated as, after the spring equinox is when Pesach has to fall. And the problem is that our 12 lunar months add up to about 354 days, which is about 11 days short of the 365 for the solar year. So you need to sort of add a few days every once in a while. The way it works nowadays is a fixed calendar every 19 years. There are 7 leap years, which means there's an extra month, the second Adar Sheni, added to those 7 extra Adar Shenis over the course of 19 years. In the time of Chizkiyahu, however, that process, I think, only started in the year 358 of the Common Era. So we're talking 1,000 years before that, when they were deciding whether or not to add an extra month based on, amongst other considerations, the calendar, the weather, the condition of the roads, and the ability for people to bring the Korban Pesach. So since Chizkiyahu took over from Ahaz right before Pesach, And because it's a din derabanan that an idol is conveys tumah, at least midrabanan, and he wanted to clean things up first, he needed some more time. So Chizkiyahu wanted to add extra month to give him an extra month to prepare for the upcoming Pesach holiday to make sure everything would be as best it could be. The problem is he only added an extra month at the last moment, and in fact, according to the Chazal, later than the last moment. What happened was he added an extra month on the last day of Adar. So the Mishnah says it was written in Nisan and he added an extra month. So that's too late. Once it's too late, once Nisan's come around, it's too late to add an extra month. So that'd be forbidden. The Gemara in Brachos, Taf Yud, says that that's not exactly what happened. What happened was is that it was the last day of Adar, meaning the 30th day of Adar, Adar Rishon. And even though witnesses hadn't come to testify to make it now the new month and of Nisan, still they could have come by the 30th, and therefore, while Chizkiyahu thought it wasn't too late to add extra month, the din is in fact that once the 30th of Adar has arrived, since it could be Nisan, it's now forbidden midrabanan to add an extra month. It's too late for that. So Chizkiyahu didn't do that. He added extra month, notwithstanding the fact that it was the 30th of Adar, and the rabbis disagreed and said, no, once it could be Nisan already, it's too late, you can't add extra month. But he did anyways, v'lahodilo, and the rabbis did not agree to that.